This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Good morning. Good morning to all the WBAI listeners here at WBAI. Law of the Land and all of our programs seek to inspire, to empower, to enlighten. We want you to become a WBAI buddy, and when you do, tell them you're doing it to support Law of the Land and the wonderful engineer I have here, Michael G. Haskins. Let them know that Law of the Land is important to you because it's important to me and to Michael to bring this program to you. Today, we're going to focus on, once again, law, but law in a bigger sense. And you know, on Law of the Land, we don't just look at the nitty-gritty law itself. We do that, but we expand it to the humanity, the people behind it, how the law affects people, what laws should be in place. And that's what we're going to focus on. Because sometimes, even though this is the most litigious country in the world, what do I mean by that? We have more laws. We have more lawyers, we have more courts than any other country that we know of. I mean, maybe China has more laws. We're not sure because they don't really keep a record of all the laws they have. But on the book, we have, when you write it up, we have the most litigious country, most lawsuits brought, people who should know their rights. Every state has its own constitution, and we have a federal U.S. constitution. All of these laws, but then sometimes there's something, even with all the laws we have, there's something missing. In this instance, we're going to look at what's missing, a law that's necessary, proposed legislation in a very important area, and that area is prosecutorial misconduct. How do we, the regular people, protect ourselves from the very government that was meant to protect us? There's always been a suspicion about the government. I mean, that was something that was actually part of the founders' ideas of the Bill of Rights, that not only would we have the structure of the government, and you see that with the actual Constitution itself, the U.S. Constitution, but then in 1791, they said we have to have protections. The people have to be protected. Protected from whom? Their own government. And that's why the First Amendment and the other amendments, but the First Amendment in particular, it says the government cannot establish a religion. The government cannot, in the First Amendment, you know, undermine someone's free exercise of religion. So you have, you know, the Establishment Clause, the Free Exercise Clause. When you get to the Fifth Amendment, it goes into the criminal issues, you know, in criminal court, and whether or not the person could be brought to before a grand jury. And that's where you see the grand jury issue. And the grand jury issue has been one of concern because as people, civilians, encounter police, and they are in this country over 1,000 each year that we know of since the Guardian newspaper has been telling the FBI and other government entities how many people are actually being gunned down by the police or dying in police custody. Over 1,000 people a year killed by police or dying in police custody. We have those like Sandra Bland in Texas who die under mysterious circumstances, hanged, and they claim she hanged herself. I don't believe it. I'm not even sorry I don't believe it. I don't. And we have others gunned down, unarmed people gunned down by police. And I've said this so many times that I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to keep saying it. How is it that a white man can go into a synagogue, go into a church, go into a theater, go into a school, gun down people, and if that white man doesn't take his own life, as we had with the Boston bomber, then that human being will live to stand trial. Yet a black man or woman, person of color, but in particular, African-American, unarmed, gunned down, murdered on the spot, no prosecution of the officer. And it's decided by the prosecutor. The prosecutor in those big cases that get attention, like those civilian-related police shootings, You have those where the police are shooting the civilian that make the news, but then there are little cases as well. And it's not little to the person who's the suspect in it, but it might be a small case that doesn't make the news because it involves a crime that may or may not be, for example, the stealing of a book bag, where someone, a teenager, is put in Rikers and left to languish there. Finally, months and months later, after his spirit is broken, because this teenager refuses to say they're guilty of a crime and take a plea bargain, that teenager then is subjected to all types of debasement in Rikers, finally released because he didn't steal a book bag. But the prosecutor wanted him to say he did. And by the time this teenager gets out, his spirit is so broken that he commits suicide. We have people who'll say, I was told by a prosecutor, either I say I did it or I get every charge in the book thrown at me. We have a criminal justice system that is overworked. We have too few judges, too few court personnel, because we're using the criminal justice system in our police department to handle social problems. The same way we use our schools to handle all of these social problems, because we won't address the problems, the core problems, but that's another story. At the end of the day, the power of the prosecutor is beyond anything the framers of this Constitution thought they would have when they devised the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, that there is this power that has no bridle to it. And this power is the power to decide whether or not a crime has been committed and worthy of going to trial. The prosecutor decides if there's enough evidence to prosecute. The prosecutor can decide whether or not this suspect who probably stole something based on, you know, a drug habit that they were trying to feed should go into a drug program as opposed to going to prison. As was stated in Democracy Now! Earlier, following to our show, there's someone who has mental illness. Instead of treating the mental illness, that person is put in jail or prison. You have people who do indeed need a 5-year timeout because they have not, or for some reason, have gained a sense that they are beyond the law and they can rob and rape and harm. But we also know the racial disparity in criminal justice means that these are decisions being made by people who have some type of sense that certain people are supposed to go to prison for longer sentences because they can handle it. And I've actually heard prosecutors and people in law say, well, you know, for a white middle-class man with a family to go to jail or for 1 year or go to prison for 1 year for the same crime that a working-class city worker is accused of doing, but that white middle-class man with a family from the suburbs is going to be hurt 3 times more because he's not used to, his sensitive sensibilities aren't used to this kind of life, like a person of color is, like the city worker is, like anybody else of another income is used to this type of life. So here we are now with this idea that certain people should go to prison and other people should get a slap on the wrist. This is based on the power of a prosecutor. And now the other part, let's go all the way around. Not just that their record, their inability to get an indictment for a police officer who's accused of shooting a civilian and then needs to go to trial so the facts can come out, like any other case. If the police officer didn't do it, then the trial will end with acquittal. If the police officer did do it, then the trial should end with a conviction. But we don't even get to trial. So if this abysmal record that the prosecutor has would be the same record that the prosecutor had with civilians, that prosecutor would not be in office. Because remember, these prosecutors, the chief prosecutor, the chief DA, runs for office. It's a political office. And too often it's this law and order type mentality in the political spectrum of I've got to prove that I'm going to be tough on crime. And what does that mean? Tough on crime means numbers, that we have to have certain people incarcerated, certain numbers of people. And we want to talk about quotas, and we need to understand there are quotas, and we have also a part of this is there's a documentary film. Now, stay with me. There's a documentary film, Crime Plus Punishment, Crime and Punishment. And the filmmaker has shown in NYPD in New York City how there are still quotas going on. In this film, 12 police officers have come forward showing that there are quotas to make arrests. Now, think about how those police officers work hand in glove with the prosecutor's office, because they're not going to arrest people if there's not going to be a follow-up conviction of some kind. So now we have this wave that's necessary because, and I hate to put it this way, because there are a lot of fine people in our police department, but they're being pimped. They're being used to finance the city government, to go out there, and the people from the police department, from the highest level down to the parking meters, down to everything, it's all being used to finance city government, not just NYPD. Across the country, they're using the police departments to finance city governments. And so once they then write the tickets, once they then put the people in the system, now the prosecutor's job is to now prosecute, not seek fairness, which some do. Like I said, with police department, there are some very good people in the police department. There are some very fair-minded people within the DA's office, district attorney's office. The problem is with absolute power, and we know absolute power corrupts absolutely, and they have absolute power. So now we're looking at the need for a law to limit that power, to put a bridle on it, to say you cannot just have this power, because once it's found out that that power is abused, there is no punishment. They have qualified immunity from being sued by the very victims who have been unfairly arrested, unfairly prosecuted, unfairly convicted, unfairly sentenced, and unfairly serving time. And when those people come out finally after, you know, the Innocence Projects or other different projects find they are innocent, there's nothing. Our city government will give the money from our tax dollars, if that is the case. It doesn't happen too often. Relatively few cases, they get money, but it's coming from our tax dollars, that then we give them money in a judgment. I want to take a moment because our guest, and you know Manuel Gomez, our guest Manuel Gomez is here, and we've always had a brilliant time with him telling us what we need to do and telling us what he has been doing to protect our rights when the police, when others have not. Private investigator Manuel Gomez, a former member of NYPD, will be with us right after you hear this short trailer from the film Crime and Punishment that speaks to the 12 New York Police Department officers who are standing up against quotas.
Not just another lawsuit. 12 cops willing to step up like this, because you're not going to get this again for 100 years.
Hold it for one quick second. Now, to record.
From the beginning, I saw how this job was. It was not about helping people. It's about numbers.
Who's targeted most? The minority community.
Boom. And all this got dismissed.
All this got dismissed.
Once you start getting arrested, it goes in your record. They're taking away jobs that they could be future lawyers, future cops.
Supervisors that are using police officers as a revenue-producing agent for the city.
This system has to change.
We all put our jobs on the line. We put everything on the line.
This is something that was placed on my desk.
You're still a police officer. And there are people in our community that don't work with police officers, period.
This is David versus Goliath. Without public support, we're nothing.
How long do you think you're going to keep the powder keg cap on?
I believe in struggle, and with struggle comes change.
Can the NYPD be what cops are supposed to be?
Can NYPD be fair? Can the prosecutor's office be fair if there aren't enough limitations, restrictions? And right now, what we're saying, there aren't enough. And Manuel Gomez is here to explain the proposed legislation that will help protect us from our government, as the founders did in the 1700s. We're still working on being protected from our own government. Thank you for joining me, Manuel.
Hey, thank you, Gloria. And once again, it's an honor to be on Law of the Land. It's a very vital show, and it definitely brings about the awareness that people need to know. Again, thank you.
And so we're going to start from the beginning, if we can, because you are my guest. You're the focus for my show today because we have so many things to unpack here. And first, how we met. We met last year, or the beginning of this year, at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah. I saw the film Crime and Punishment. I heard what was said, and I said, I have to have this man on my show, and we have to talk about the NYPD still using quotas. Tell us a little bit about that, but also about how you then, once people are arrested arbitrarily, then help them find justice.
Well, first of all, you know, the film Crime and Punishment shows the actual quota system of not only tickets, but it shows the quota system of how people generate money off the backs of our young. They generate money giving tickets over almost $900 million a year on people being falsely arrested or illegal car stops and so forth. And then Crime and Punishment court catches this. It shows it on film. It shows cops being retaliated against or speaking out against quotas. And it was one of the inspirations that caused me to generate a new proposal called the Department of Civilian Justice, a mechanism which would give relief to cops and to regular citizens to report retaliation from the police department and retaliation from which I call the untouchables, the district attorney's office, who, you know, can commit crimes and they have immunity. They can turn around and lock you up, hold you in jail for 3 years, and then your defense attorney can find out that you're innocent and there is no mechanism to punish that district attorney. And they still keep doing their job, falsely arresting people. Now, I used to be a cop, and one thing I never thought I would say, but it wasn't until I became a prime investigator that I could provide the justice that I couldn't give as a cop. Now I give as a prime investigator. And in the past 3.5 years, I've freed 98 people who were falsely arrested, all right? And this is throughout the entire state of New York, not just New York City. And it's showed me in this journey that I would estimate maybe 25 to 30% of the people in our current penal system are innocent, shouldn't be there. And so
one of your clients was Pedro Hernandez. And tell us about that case.
Well, the Pedro Hernandez case, I mean, is one of the most egregious cases I've ever had. This kid was falsely arrested 12 times. I represented him in 6 cases. All 12 cases were dismissed, and all the 6 cases I represented were dismissed. He was accused of attempted murder 3 times, okay, and for robbery 3 other times. And all of them were falsified by a detective. And not only were they falsified by a police detective, but here's the ironic thing. They were falsified with an assistant district attorney, David Slott, who has been removed from prosecuting cases now, but now is in the appeals court. So I had concrete evidence showing that they were using one witness to falsely incarcerate more than 50 kids on 50 different crimes. And it was the same district attorney with the same detectives. I mean, and it's insanity. And I fought it and fought it and fought it, and I finally got his cases dismissed. The case went national. But the inspiration for me with that case was is that the prosecutorial misconduct. What does a regular person do? Who do you report the prosecutor on? And when I ask that question, I get the crickets. Nobody knows the answer. Well, now, a friend of mine, his name is Frank Serpico from the movie Serpico, I brought this proposal to the Department of Civil Justice. And I said to him, Frank, you know, I need you to look at this. And he calls me the kid. He goes, kid, are you sure you think you're going to get it done? Because I was in a movie, got paid millions of dollars, and they never changed anything. And I told him, well, you have 2 choices. You're either with me or you're with me. Because I'm going to make this happen because he started it. He saw what I did, he put his spin on it, and now we finally went from a proposal, which I'm proud to announce on WBAI, to a state bill. And I got tremendous assemblywoman who's backing it, Assemblywoman Natalia Fernandez. And we're going to now have the first state bill for a new agency called the Department of Civilian Justice, which is the first of its kind nationwide. And now there's something else I'm going to announce to you that nobody knows, which this is the first place I'm announcing it. I just got wind that Connecticut now is also going to introduce my bill as well. So now I got two states that are going to simultaneously propose my bill to their Senate for this new agency to bring justice and relieve the people who cannot get justice. And the thing about the difference of this bill is that it not only gives the regular mother, the poor kid, the black family, the Jewish family, the Italian family, everybody, transcends color, a chance to get justice. But not only that, but it also reinforces the very judicial system, because what it does is it gives cops the ability to report corruption without fear of retaliation, which is the basis for the film of Crime and Punishment. Okay, and that's why it's so key that, you know, everybody see this film, because it gives you an eye-opening experience. There's no acting. Everything you see is 100% real. And this new agency is going to let cops be good cops. And the bad cops, they're going to be able to get rid of them. Now, and this thing agency does one other important thing. It gives the power to this agency, the Department of Civilian Justice, to have subpoena powers and to investigate everybody from the police commissioner down to the person who washes the windows. That means that if the police commissioner is corrupt, this agency will have the power to fire him, regardless of who appointed him. It will have the power to fire the district attorney. And there's 62 counties in New York. That's 62 district attorneys, which will now will be held accountable. And then another place of corruption, where corruption runs rampant, the Department of Corrections. You know, Serpico said 20% of the cops are corrupt. The other 80% want to be good. Listen to that. 20% are corrupt and the other 80% want to be good. They are scared to speak out. We have the people that are appointed to protect us are scared to speak out against the injustice. Because if you turn around and tell your police captain, hey, I'm not stopping Gloria B. Marshall because she's black and driving a BMW. No, I'm not going to stop her for no reason. You will get suspended. You will get your vacation taken away. You will be transferred to other locations. You will be put on a corner somewhere in a desolate area. And this is what the movie Crime and Punishment shows. You actually see it on film. Again, there is no acting. And that film, as I said, is one of the bases for this new legislation. And you know why? It's going to bring about change.
And that's what really is at the core of this, bringing about change. The power of the prosecutor, once the case has been, the person has been arrested, the case has been presented, or the issue has been presented to the prosecutor, making that decision, do we prosecute? And if so, what charges? And we're not saying, and I've heard prosecutors say, it's not like we can just pull charges out of the sky. No, but you know how to work the system to decide what charges you can put in and what can sound, what also sounds very scary to somebody when you're talking to them, saying, as this one prosecutor used to say, well, if you make me have to go to trial, you make me have to work. If you make me have to do all this, then you're going to pay the price. So basically, if you actually exercise your constitutional rights and say, no, I did not do this, and you're going to have to prove me guilty because I believe I am innocent, then we're going to put every charge in that we could possibly put in so that hopefully the jury will find you guilty of something, because you have the audacity to want to actually protect and exercise your constitutional rights to have a trial.
You hit on a perfect point. You know, and when you say about they're going to try to hit you with every charge because you want to have your right as a trial. What you just touched on, Gloria, is something that almost nobody knows about. And what it is called is the prosecutor's quota. The prosecutors, the assistant district attorneys, they have a quota. They have a quota of how many people they should find guilty and so forth, because they get promoted on how many convictions they get, not on the performance of their job, but if they get so many convictions, they look like superstars. So what they do is, here's Gloria, or no, here's Manuel, who's arrested allegedly for robbing a bodega, and then they find out that the guy that robbed the bodega had blue eyes and I have brown eyes, and they hold me in jail for 2 years. Now, when the time comes that they realize they're going to let me go, they say, well, you know what? How about we just say you plead time served and you can go home right now. Now, most of these young kids, they're like, oh, my God, I got to get out of here. And they take the plea. And this was the case in Crime and Punishment where you see Pedro Hernandez. They offered him a plea 4 times. And they did the same thing to that other kid that hung himself. I forget his name. You was talking about him.
Broward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Broward.
And this is the problem. You know, they get, I would say, at least 40% of their convictions are people that take pleas who are innocent. And they scare them into taking these pleas. This is abuse of power. Okay? This is power that goes unchecked. Do you know that the President of the United States has oversight? This country is built on, you know, the executive branch checking the legislative branch checking the judicial branch, right? Each system of government checks the other to make sure they're doing the right thing. Now, if we can have that kind of oversight over our U.S. government and over our president and over our Congress members and our senators, why don't we have it over the district attorneys? Why don't we have it over the police chiefs? Who is supposed to be above the law in this country? No one. It's like you said before, Machiavelli said in Chapter 6 of The Prince, absolute power absolutely corrupts. Well, like he said in Chapter 6 as well, I am not here to accept the status quo, but to destroy it. Okay? I will not tolerate this type of absolute power anymore. I've fought terrorists overseas. I'm a Desert Storm veteran. I'm an Afghanistan veteran. I've been to Africa. I've been to Uzbekistan and other countries you can't even enunciate, and Afghanistan. And you want to know, I saw so much corruption, so much injustice. But even though I've seen all that, this country shows me one thing. It's still one of the best countries in the world because, like you said, it has the most laws on the books to protect human rights. Except what's going on right now tears at the very fabric of our U.S. Constitution. The Sixth Amendment states you have the right to face your accusers. You have the right to present your evidence in court. You have the right to a speedy trial. We got kids right now waiting 4 and 5 years to go to court who are innocent. So we're destroying their lives, criminalizing them, demonizing them, sticking them in a judicial system, and they're innocent. They're not even getting to court quickly. This is the problem we have, and this is why we need to have oversight, and this is why was the inspiration for me to write the Department of Civil Justice, because I've had mothers come crying to me and say to me, no one will listen to me. Well, now what I'm doing is I'm giving a voice to the voiceless. You know, I have a case right now you might have seen on the news, Wendy Martinez. It was the mother that was shot in the eye through the peephole of the door, and she was gangland murdered. She was executed this past Saturday at approximately 10 p.m. at night. And the sad thing about this case is that her son was in jail for 4 years, okay? No, 3 years. And I got him out a year ago because when I did the investigation, I found that the prosecutor's office was hiding evidence. They were hiding the evidence that someone else had the murder weapon. They had a video confession from another kid stating that he had the murder weapon at the time of the murder. And do you know that they hid that video from the defense attorney for 2 years? And then it wasn't until I got on the case that I found the video. And then when I found the video, I said, oh, my God, this kid is innocent. What's going on? So then I presented my evidence to the defense attorney. I gave it into court. The prosecutor's office went bananas, the Bronx DA's office. And when they heard and saw the evidence, they released Brian Solano on second-degree murder. They released him on his own recognizance. You know, the funny thing about the kid calls me up from upstate, and he goes, Mr. Gomez, can you pick me up? And I'm like, Brian, what do you mean pick you up? Where are you? Did you escape? And he goes, no, they just opened the door and said, get out of here. They didn't even tell anyone. They just opened the door and said, get out of here. They let him out the door in an orange prison suit with letters and numbers on it, And he calls me to go pick him up upstate, 2 or 3 hours away. And I did. And I brought him home. And but now I was saying to the prosecutor's office, so was the defense attorney, and this was on the record, that this family was getting death threats. Do you know they did nothing for them? Now the mother just got shot in the face. And she leaves behind a 15-year-old son who's a straight-A student and a great athlete and a 25-year-old son who has no father. And now we're trying to, you know, help that family. We just did a GoFundMe page for them, and they just raised $12,000. We're trying to raise the $14,000 to bury the mother. You know, it's just insane. And this is what kills me, because if this judicial system would have acted sooner and released this kid, this mother would be alive.
And the fact that the prosecutor's office, because you showed that they were hiding exculpatory evidence, and exculpatory evidence is evidence that supports one's innocence, inculpatory evidence is evidence that supports one's guilt, and under the law, the Brady evidence is evidence that the prosecutor must hand over to the defense counsel, because we have in the system police officers and investigators and all these people on the side of the government. And so when those investigators find evidence that supports the innocence of the accused, the exculpatory evidence, that evidence must be turned over to the defense counsel. And here's another gaping hole in the power dynamic. And when that prosecutor does not turn over exculpatory evidence, then what is the punishment, since there's qualified immunity that prevents that prosecutor from being sued by the victim? And this is what we're talking about with this department. We're gonna take a music break right this moment and come back with Manuel Gomez. He's got so much more to share with you. And this Department of Civilian Justice, he's got the proposed law, the proposed bill. It's something that he can actually send out so you can look at it, because, you know, my listeners want to be on the case and they want to know what it is that they can do to help this go forward. We're going to talk about that when we get back from this musical break. This is WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I am Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and this is Law of the Land, and we're here with Manuel Gomez. We'll be right back. Better days are coming. Keep that in mind. That's Leandria Johnson. Better days. And so necessary, because we're hearing good news. I know there's been a gray cloud that's been following this country around, and we won't go into the historical aspects that, you know, those who are in need, in pain, deserve justice, have been denied for so long. And so here we have a proposed law that Manuel Gomez, and this law has the names Manuel Gomez as well as Frank Serfico. And I want to just talk a little bit about the proposed law and what it is meant to do. We're here with Manuel Gomez. And for those of you who want to call in a little later, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We will have a little bit of time to take maybe one or two calls, 212-209-2877. Let's talk a little bit more with Manuel as the calls queue up, and we'll be able to take one or two calls, because we know when Manuel Gomez is on our show, everybody wants to speak with him. So, Manuel, thanks again for joining me. Let's go the proposed law itself.
Sure.
The
first thing, this proposal of this new agency is going to it's going to be comprised of civilians, all right? It's going to have civilian investigators who have no affiliation with any police department, attorney's office, corrections, or fire department. So that gives people a fair and impartial investigation. That's one. Second, it's going to have judges who will also have no affiliation with any police departments, corrections, criminal courts, or so forth. We're going to take the best of our defense attorneys, all right, who are not prosecutors, and make them judges. The cream of the crop, the guys like Earl Ward, guys like Norman Siegel, all right, guys like Steve Siegel, all right, we're going to make them into judges, and that will give a fair and impartial hearing. Third, it's going to take away all administrative trials from the police department, from the district attorney's office, Department of Corrections, and the fire department. It's going to hold the administrative hearings now within the Department of Civil and Justice to ensure that a cop, correction officer, or fireman, or a prosecutor gets a fair hearing. But that also is going to ensure that the public that's making the allegation against them gets a fair hearing as well. Okay? That's third. Fourth, it's going to have the ability to have subpoena powers. So that means that the police commissioner says, well, I'm not releasing that information. This new agency, the Department of Civil and Justice Investigator, will have the power to suspend the police commissioner on the spot. All right? You will not. It will not let anybody inhibit the law. It will hold everyone accountable. It will bring full circle to the word accountability and oversight. And that's the part that Serpico wanted to add in there. He wanted to make it so that when a supervisor sees corruption happening and looks the other way, like you saw in Crime and Punishment, where the supervisor tells A1 Raymond, well, I have to give you a bad evaluation because you're a black man with dreads who is well-educated and well-spoken. He said that to him, which was we got on audio. What happened to that sergeant for falsifying his evaluation? Nothing. And that's shown in Crime and Punishment. That is one of the mechanisms that's in the Department of Civil Justice so that when supervisors like that, we can get rid of them, fire them, and suspend them. There is no reason for the public to keep paying millions and hundreds of millions of dollars a year in lawsuits. And what do? We don't do anything. Everybody screams, no justice, no peace. This is going to bring justice, and this is going to bring peace. The other thing that the agency is going to do also, it's going to have a social awareness program. So it's going to reach out to everybody in New York State and let them know that the Department of Civil and Justice works. Here's how to contact us. They're going to do public commercials and so forth. I incorporated this into the bill so that there's a public awareness program so that people can know that this program is there for them so that no matter where you walk in the state, you can get justice. You know, we have now a prosecutorial misconduct law which is in place. Actually, one of my good friends, he was an example for it. His name is Boss Jr., and he was a black man up in Troy, New York, who was falsely arrested for arson, an insurance job. And that was the catalyst for the reason for the prosecutorial misconduct, because the prosecutor falsified his case and put him in jail for 2 years. And then they paid him like $300,000. Now, when they paid this man this money, they just said, get out of here, live your life. We have to stop this mentality thinking that writing people checks solves the problem. It doesn't. The Department of Civil and Justice goes to the very heart of that, and it's going to stop that. It's going to give a mechanism of relief to the government, to the people of New York, and to the taxpayers. Why should we pay over $300 million a year on lawsuits? And that's just New York. Now, backing this proposal is, and I'm proud to say, the Austin NAACP, chapter of the NAACP, the Peekskill NAACP. Also backing me now is Frank Serpico, and also Norman Siegel, who's the former president of ACLU. And now we're getting on board the Innocence Project. Jim Vetros is in the process of working that. We're trying to get Barry Scheck to come up with us. We're going to be having a hearing in Albany sometime in the end of February or the beginning of March, which we're going to be announcing. I want to also announce to people that you can go on my website and download the template for this bill, which is called Department of Civil Justice, go on Black Ops Private Investigators. And again, that's Black Ops, OPS, B-L-A-C-K, OPS, Private Investigators. Click on the tab which says legislation, and you can download the actual bill draft. So, and I'm doing it. I put it out there for the public so that everyone could have it, so that every state could have it. So it's an example for every state to follow. So far, we're going to have two states making this happen, which is New York and Connecticut. I'm trying to get New Jersey in on it as well. And if I can accomplish that, that means I would have helped over 100 million people. And that's
so
that's my goal.
Let's go through this. The Department of Civilian Justice, a state department, part of New York State, that will have hearings based on a complaint against a prosecutor, complaint against the police department. So we're talking about a statewide agency that would usurp the power of the New York Attorney General's office. Now, the New York Attorney General's office before said they would step in if there was a police shooting that involved an unarmed civilian, and they would put in their own prosecutor to prosecute that case. But the person had to be completely unarmed and shot down by a police officer. We also have the New York Attorney General's office that is supposed to, I'm assuming, protect the rights of all people in New York State. But sometimes we don't know how to access that department. This department now is going to be one that is going to have its own trial system. And when you have a chance to look at the Department of Civilian Justice, Manuel has actually set out a chart that shows the commissioner of the Department of Civilian Justice that has a two-term limit, so they cannot stay in office forever. We have department deputy commissioner in this department. And it's a breakdown. And this is the beginning. There are still some places that need to be filled. This is the beginning of a law. We know in our legal process, we have different sides come into it and put in and take out and mold the law based on political power. Who has the political power to get this passed? How does this get passed? I know people out there are thinking this, like, how is it going to get funded? Who would want to put the money into this proposed bill so that they could pay for the commissioner, not the commissioner, but the commissioner of the Department of Civilian Justice and the people who are necessary to run this? So when you're talking about the nitty-gritty of getting this off the ground, who do you see as using this kind of bill to better put forward the justice that this state needs?
Well, you know what? First, and I'm glad you put up three great points, you know, how are we going to pay for it? How are we going to get it done? And then where is it going to be? Well, let me start from number three, and I'll work my way to number one. First of all, we have courthouses throughout the state of New York that are beautiful structures built like fortresses, like castles, and they're abandoned. They're not even being used. We have courthouses that can be refurbished and facilitate this new department in every county of New York. That's my goal. So we don't have to spend the money on the buildings. The infrastructure is already there. We're just not using it. We just need to spend a little money to revamp the building. Now we said, where do we get this money from? And I'll show you where. Do you know that we have over almost $200 million a year in surpluses from the bridges, from all these tolls that we pay, which everybody hates paying over the Whitestone, the Throbbing Snake, or the Tappan Zee? I want to take a small percentage of that surplus and put that to pay for this. The public doesn't need to pay any more than it already pays. That's the second. So that's the other way to pay it. Second, to now make this a reality, we're having this hearing. We're having people. We're asking people, write your senator, write your city council member, and tell them, I want you to support the Department of Civilian Justice. And not only that, but we're having a hearing up in Albany in Room B, which will be with 500 people, and it's open to the public. I'm asking everyone to come. Everyone, you
and when and when is this? And when is this hearing? We're going to take one call. We only have time for one call. But as we queue up this call, when is this hearing so people can start preparing for it?
It's going to be sometime in, like I said, late February or the beginning of March. I'll know by the Assemblywoman what date it'll be. But I'll be posting it up on my website on the legislation section. And I'll be also putting it out on the Instagram and emails. And there's also going to be a major news conference. So everybody will get about a month's notice to come.
Excellent. Excellent.
Thank you.
So let's just take this quick call. Is the caller on? Okay. We just lost that call. But that gives us a little more time to talk. We have 2 minutes, unfortunately, as we channel down. Please give us the name of the website again where they can find the Department of Civilian Justice information.
It's Black, BLACK, OPS, OPS, Private Investigators with an S. Again, Black Ops, Private Investigators, or just click on Private Investigator Manuel Gomez. It'll come onto the website, and then you'll see it'll say Legislation and the Services, and you'll click on that. There's also a 16-minute speech of me speaking to the NAACP upstate New York, and you can hear exactly all the intricacies and all the things that make it possible and why we need this bill. I mean, there's too many people right now in the system that are unjustly incarcerated, and too many kids out there now, like you said before, are being forced to take pleas when they're innocent. And this is a crime, and we need to put an end to this. In New York,
so when you go, yes, but yeah. Because the rest of the states follow a state like New York, especially when it comes to policing. When it comes to policing, NYPD is not just your New York City Police Department. It is not. It is a national example, and I'm going to say it's an international example. What NYPD does, other states will follow, and other countries will follow. So when NYPD started this whole stop and frisk, you started to see stop and frisk happen across the country. Racial profiling followed, the quota systems followed, and they started doing stop and frisk in other countries as well. So what we're talking about, NYPD and this Department of Civilian Justice, if this Department of Civilian Justice gets off of the ground, and we're praying that it will, this will be, as Manuel's pointed out, an example. As we see, Connecticut and other states will come up with their version, because once you look at it logically, how do prosecutors have all this unbridled power? And you might say, well, they could lose their law license, or they could have the judge in the room who's supposed to keep the prosecutor in check. But that judge only knows what the prosecutor is putting forward in the courtroom. They don't know what evidence that prosecutor, as you've pointed out, might have been hiding the entire time. That comes out later. And once that comes out, then what happens to that prosecutor? Too often, it's a slap on the wrist. And I want the name again of that prosecutor in the Bronx that you found had been working with one of the police detectives to have these 50 people who were found to be innocent and yet had been railroaded. What was the name of that prosecutor?
I was Assistant District Attorney David Slott, but it wasn't just one. It was also Assistant District Attorney Christine Scacia and also District Attorney Darcel Clark. They all knew about this. And then we had the same problem in Queens. In Queens, I got a corrupt judge over there stopping evidence from coming into the case, with ADA Karen Ross from Queens, and also Judge Kenneth Olber. I mean, we have a case now with a giant meal, and they're stopping evidence from coming in the trial that proves someone innocent. Again, it's like you said, they have too much power, and no one is checking them. No one. And that's why I call them the untouchables. But there's one last thing I want to say. You nailed it on the head when you said the police department is the example for the United States. 38 states. And this is a fact. You can all verify this by going online and Google the NY Police PD patrol guide. And you'll see that those patrol guide procedures are copied in 38 states. We are the example. New York State is the example for the United States to follow. And countries like London and France, they come here to copy our procedures. This is why you see the same problems, the same systemic issues and corruption and people being tortured and killed in Alabama, like it's going on right now. You see the same procedures, the same police procedures. So when you copy the procedures, you copy the problem. Unfortunately,
when you copy the procedure, you copy the problem. And the problem is unbridled power. And one of the solutions is the Department of Civilian Justice. Thank you so much, Manuel.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us, Manuel Gomez. Once again, private investigator Manuel Gomez. Just put his name in whatever search engine you use. Then his website will come up. Go to proposed legislation. Read about the Department of Civilian Justice. Empower, inspire not just yourself, but others as well. And we do it here on WBAI. Thank you so much for joining me. And you will be back on this program, Manuel, if I have anything to do with it.
Thank you. God bless you all.
And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We've had a very, very important proposed legislation presented to us, and we need to know more about it. You need to read it, find out what you can and cannot embrace. As we have in this democracy, the ability to put your input into the laws, should be, into the laws that are put forward. And this, if we're going to do what we need to do to make sure we are protected, then this is self-protection. And we need to be invested in it. We need to know what's going on. And he's going to come back closer to the time of the rally, if not before, to let us know what we can do to get our support behind this proposed legislation. I want to have, if I could, take one moment out for this announcement. Once again, I'm putting forward the 400th commemoration in August of 2019, that will be the 400th year of the arrival, marking the arrival of Africans into the Virginia colony in 1619. The colony was founded in 1607. It is the permanent English colony in North America. And in 1619, this fledging, I'm talking about, this colony was dying off. They were practicing cannibalism. It was a miserable place to be, and these Africans then taught these colonists how to farm, because they were urbanites coming from London, how to farm, how to raise cattle, how to survive. They come up with this crop, tobacco, and then what do? To pay off the hard labor and knowledge and wisdom of these Africans, create slave laws. The debate now is, were these Africans enslaved when they arrived? I say no. There were no slave laws in the colony, and that's why you could have Mary and Anthony Johnson. Please look up Mary and Anthony Johnson. This is an African couple who married in the colony, purchased land, and had servants of their own in the 1600s, Mary and Anthony Johnson. And not only did they have servants, they had black and white servants in the 1600s. And this is why I say, when this country, we come to a crossroad, and then when we get to that crossroad, when we decide, are we going to base our ideals in something beyond greed? Usually not. And they changed the laws, took away the land when they had the voting rights that they could have had that came with that land. We're talking about 400 years of perseverance. And that's the theme for this commemoration coming up. We want you to be ambassadors for the 400th anniversary commemoration, August. There are going to be events all around the country and parts of the world leading into August. Events now at NYU are starting, events in other parts of Virginia, events in other parts of the world. This is Law of the Land. We're here to inspire, to inform, to enlighten. Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Become a BAI buddy. And I'll see you, my friend, on the radio. Thank you, Michael G.